still have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve, I think, 3 to 5. I'll figure it out as I go along.
Well, how about you reserve
five,
and then if you, that works better. He needs a time.
Depends on the level of nervousness when I get
there. That's okay. Come on up. You're Ms. White.
Yes, I am, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mary Elizabeth White, and I represent Thaddeus Anthony Ruane, the appellant in this matter. The issue before the court is actually very discreet. Unlike our last appeal before this court, there's really only one issue, and that is whether or not the trial court violated the edict of Rule 1:1 when he entered a qualifying court order that conflicts with the final decree in November of 2016. And the issue there is the Survivor Benefit Plan, and I'll refer to that as the SBP in this case. And this case has a history of many orders being entered. There's final decree, an amended final decree, there's one qualifying court order, second and a third, and I'll refer to this as the third QCO. This divides the husband's military pension and also awards a survivor benefit plan to the wife. And our point is the court didn't have the authority to do that. The order was, the final decree, final order was more than 21 days old. It was closed and it wasn't reopened. And I believe the case that's most relevant to this court is the Dixon against Pew case, where the court.
You would concede, though, that if this were nothing more than what would be tantamount to a non-proton, that Rule 1:1 would not apply.
I'm not sure if I concede that, Your Honor, and I'll tell the court why. The court did not actually make that order. He never did say, I'm awarding the SBP. He talked about it, he went around it, it was discussed, but he never actually made that order. Then there was a final decree that was written. It was never ordered.
But it was actually discussed amongst the parties as well as the court that the intention was, in terms of the SPP, to be given to the wife.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So if the court then comes back with the posture or position that it inadvertently, for whatever reason, didn't include it in its final order, why wouldn't that be included in the non-proton statute?
Well, there are actually two. You're talking about the statute that allows to correct omissions.
Right. Because that's essentially the allegation,
right,
that they're correcting the order.
Right.
And it's not a new proposition.
Right. And that's what the judge said. I'm going back and correcting. And there's two exceptions to go back and do that. And one is an inadvertent omission. And then the other is... And I'm getting very nervous, and I'm just going to go ahead and focus on what the
court
asked me.
We're not that mean, I promise.
Okay, you're not that mean.
But mistake would be the other.
Okay.
Omission or mistake.
Omission or mistake, that is correct. Well, let's talk about both of those, and I would ask the court to take a look at the Dixon against Pew case. And there the judge actually said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to give the wife a lump sum spousal support award, and then I'm going to give her periodic spousal support, and the court laid out everything that it was going to do. But he didn't, and he didn't reserve jurisdiction. He just gave her the periodic spousal support. So when the wife went back and said, oh, wait a minute, you talked about it. You said you were going to do it. Judge says, you know, you're right. I talked about it, and there was clear evidence in the record, but the Supreme Court came back and said, no, the court didn't reserve jurisdiction. So in that case, the trial court did not reserve jurisdiction to go back and order that. And it was even more clear in Dixon, where the judge actually said, this is what I'm going to do. Our judge actually admitted, you know, I didn't address that. And it's right there in the transcript. He says, I don't know if it was because it was something that wasn't contested in this case and everything else was contested. He said, but the court did not address that. So now we talk about the agreement. Can these parties confer jurisdiction on the trial court by agreement? Well, number one, the agreement didn't exist when we went back in November of 2016, but I think the Wilson case lays that to rest, and I've cited that in my brief, and it says it doesn't really matter what the parties intend, and that was a case where the husband had actually signed an agreement to amend the quadro. He'd initialed it, signed it, it was an agreement in writing. Then when the court entered it, he said, you know what, I don't agree, and he contested that, and the Court of Appeals found that just because the parties agreed that the court could do this at one time did not confer jurisdiction on the court. So I think it's a two-pronged answer to the court's question. One, we could not confer that jurisdiction on the court even though we did have an agreement. And number two, the trial court didn't reserve the jurisdiction. This is Rule 1:1. There were five bites at this apple.
But how does that break down if the position of the court, which it seems to be taking, is that it was inadvertent, it was a mistake, as Judge Clements was indicating as one of the exceptions?
Well, let's talk about a mistake. If it's an inadvertent mistake, does an inadvertent mistake last for 4 months while a court has suspended a final order? Because this final decree was suspended from August of 2015 until December of 2015. So we had that entire time it was suspended for us to address all those issues. It still wasn't included. There was a QCO entered. It wasn't addressed. There was another QCO entered. It wasn't addressed. It wasn't until the third QCO. So at what point does it become inadvertent? This was an omission. It's clear. It wasn't ordered. It wasn't included by anyone who wrote the order. It wasn't included by the judge. It was an omission, but an inadvertent omission over a period of time, I think that strains the definition of inadvertent.
But there is no time limit under the statute, is there?
No, Your Honor, there is not. I will agree with that. But how long does Rule 1:1 come in effect? It's a final order. And in the Dixon versus Pugh case, the court didn't reserve jurisdiction. The judge could simply have said there was a lot going on in this case. And in fact, he said that one time during the ruling. He said, did I miss anything with the property? Did I miss anything? Bring it up.
What is the purpose of having 801-428 if it's not to infect? Correct.
If the judge comes, if there's an agreement or the judge comes out and says, I award this to the wife, if it had been included in the oral transcript but not made it into the final decree, then when we went back and tried to enter the QCO, come back and say, no, clear from the record. Dixon was even more clear. He actually said that. He said, I'm going to do this for the wife, but he didn't reserve the jurisdiction to do it. This court didn't even say he was going to do it. It was talked all around. It was mentioned a couple of times, but no one actually said the wife gets it. The court did not order it, and it did not make it into the final decree. It's not in the transcript, and it's not in the final order. So the court, had the court simply said, and I reserve jurisdiction if I missed anything to make any award, I think we'd have a different case. But the court didn't. It didn't reserve any jurisdiction to make any other award.
So your point is that after the fact, at a separate hearing, if the judge says, well, obviously that was the intent of the parties and I meant to do that, that's not sufficient for entering a non-protunct order?
No, Your Honor, not under the Dixon case, the Supreme Court case, because there he actually talked about it. So here we have the final hearing, we had an oral ruling, we had the entry of the order, we had three QCOs, and not once did the court address it. Not once did the court say the wife gets the survivor benefit plan, and there was no reservation of jurisdiction. So now we have a qualifying court order, which is essentially a quadro. It's the arm that carries out the intent of the final order that doesn't reflect what's in the final order. The final order still doesn't have that language in it, but we have a qualifying court order, essentially a quadro, an arm that says it's entered to carry out the effect of the final decree that doesn't comport with what is written in the final order. So even if you get there, even if you say, yes, that judge had jurisdiction to do that, don't we now have a reverse situation where we have a QCO, a quadro, that doesn't carry out the terms of the order? You can't. A court cannot add terms to a qualifying court order that's not contained in the final order of divorce. It's just not there. And that was conceded by the trial judge. Didn't address it. Didn't give it. Didn't reserve jurisdiction. Were there any other questions from the panel?
Thank you, counsel.
I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Geisler?
Geisler, yes. May it please the court. My name is Darcy Geisler, and I represent Cynthia Ann Lewayne, the appellee in this case. The question to be decided by this panel is whether or not the trial court abused its inherent and statutory discretion under 8.01-428B when it corrected the qualified court order to specifically award the wife the SVP.
Counsel, let me stop you because I think the word corrected has a very interesting weight to it because I think, obviously, that's I think why you're here. There's
yes.
This argument from the appellant that it's not a corrected order. What is your position in reference to the fact that these were terms that were not included? Even though you do have comments that everybody wanted to include the SPD.
I believe that you can look at Cass v. Lassiter, with this court in 1986, said that in the absence of any explanation as to why the parties in the court may have intended to include inconsistent provisions or how both could be enforceable, the trial court had clear and convincing evidence to support its finding of a clerical error justifying correction. In this case, we have the SVP ordered to be paid by the wife in the final decree twice and in each qualified court order. That alone shows that something was happening with the SVP. This is not boilerplate language that falls down the line. This was actually, as part of her term, she's to receive 50% of the marital portion of the military retirement, less the cost of the SVP. The court also went on to say, to ensure that she receives 50% less the cost of the SVP. There seemed to have been, because the only issue that the court had to decide between the parties on the SVP issue was how it was to be paid.
Is it fatal, though, that the technical words award are not used?
I don't believe so, because first of all of the case law, Dixon v. Pugh itself, School Board of the City of Lynchburg versus Caudill, and Netzer versus Reynolds, all three of those say that it can be on any competent evidence. There is no requirement that there be a specific award somewhere. Any competent evidence required in the court. And it also goes in Cass versus Lassiter, where you simply had an agreement that was submitted to the court by the parties. There was no finding by the court that those were the specific terms. So you can look at that, as well as the fact that there are instances of this competent and specific evidence. And the court did make the award. It did this when the court said she is going to be given the maximum survivor annuity. The court said it in its oral ruling, and it said she's going to have to pay for the SPP, but she is awarded the maximum survivor annuity. When we went back on this case to have this order corrected, the court also went back and said, that's what I was referring to. I was referring to the fact that she received the maximum pension benefit, the maximum survivor annuity.
Doesn't this case then come down to the question of whether or not the court intended to do it and didn't, Dixon v. Pugh, or whether the court did it and it didn't get in there, which would be an omission?
On the issue of Dixon versus Pugh limits itself specifically to the issues of reservation of jurisdiction and spousal support awards. So I would argue that it is, in that matter, it's not applicable here, because we're not dealing with a reservation of jurisdiction. We're not dealing with the court coming in and saying, I'm going to hold on to this past 21 days, and later I'm going to come in and make a decision. What we have here is the parties came before the court and said, this is what we want to happen. The judge said, I'm going to give her the maximum survivor annuity, and she's got to pay for it out of her portion of military retirement. He wrote it in the order twice. Though that same language was replicated in the qualified court orders, and it was not brought to the court's attention that there was an issue until there was an issue, until the husband refused to sign the paperwork necessary.
But you would agree that the specific language, which is at issue here,
yes,
is not in any order previous to this particular order on appeal.
The actual specific award, yes, was
so
is an inadvertent.
So doesn't it then come down to the question of whether or not it was intended and not done, or whether it was done but not specified?
I think the fact that it was intended to be done can be gleaned from both the court statement that it intended to do it, as well as all of the references in the record.
Well, don't you have a problem if that's the resolution of the issue? I mean, if it was intended but not done, then you can't add it. But if it was intended, done but not included, then you could include it.
I see what you're saying. Yes, I do believe that it was done. I do believe that the court, when it recited back, she will receive the maximum survivor annuity, said this is being done. And then it was inadvertently left out of the order.
The trial court said it was an omission.
Yes. It said it was a very clear omission.
It didn't say it was a mistake. It said it was an omission.
Correct. From the order.
Yes.
That the specific award was clearly inadvertently omitted from the order, and that it basically jumped to the fact that she had to pay for it, which is usually the issue that is dealt with, that is argued about, and that was the only issue that was dealt with by the court in this case. And so it jumped from, since everyone agreed, everyone had requested that this be awarded to the wife, the court jumped to the part that he had to rule on.
If the judge says it's an omission, where in the record prior to that does it support that conclusion?
There are 10 places that the record supports that this was actually supposed to be included. The first, in the husband's testimony, says, "Sir, are you willing to designate your wife as a survivor beneficiary of your military retirement?" And his response was, "Yes, ma'am."
Okay, but where does, in the record, does it show that the judge made that determination?
If you look at all of this in the final argument, I think one of the most compelling ones is husband's counsel actually says, "We're asking for the same thing. There is no contest but that the wife gets the survivor benefit plan." The court then responded to that in his ruling and said she will get the maximum survivor annuity. Then, in post-trial briefing, the wife recited back what she believed that the court had already ruled.
And what appendix site is that you're reading from?
Which one?
In terms of what the court said about the maximum.
That's at appendix 21. And then the court clarified that that is what he meant in appendix 223. He stated, "Counsel will note that this court made reference to a division of the pension benefit after deducting the cost of the SVP." But the wife recited back in her post-trial briefing that the court had ruled the wife shall receive 50% of the marital share. That wasn't her request. That was her recitation of what had happened. There was no objection. In the husband's post-trial briefing, he also submitted to the court, "Mr. Ruane requests that this honorable court award Ms. Ruane 50% of the marital share of military retirement with full survivor benefits with monthly SVP premium to be paid by Ms. Ruane." The court then looked at the final ruling where he orally ruled on it. The court looked at Ms. Ruane and said, "You will receive 50% of the marital share of the military retirement in this case after deduction of the survivor benefits costs." This gets us under Cass v. Lassiter and the fact that this court held you need to look, it is evidence, if there is no way for the order to be implemented or how it could be enforced. So how in this case could the SVP cost be borne by Ms. Ruane if she didn't get the award? As the court queried to counsel at the last hearing, he actually asked, does it make sense that she would have to pay for another woman's SVP? Because that's what the order would require at this point. She can't. If the husband's interpretation is correct, and we are to go by the specific ruling of the final decree, as well as the qualified court orders that have been already entered, then she has to pay for the new Ms. Ruane's SVP benefit. Is that really what the court intended? When both parties at the time of ruling, not subsequently, as in the Wilson case that Ms. White brings up. In Wilson, the attempt to modify and to gain subject matter jurisdiction occurred because the parties came up with an agreement subsequent to the 21-day passage. And they said, well, we can come in and make this decision and we can change it because we agree. Correct. No, you can't obtain subject matter jurisdiction. They weren't making a correction. They were making a modification, which is where 20-107.3K comes in. We're looking at a correction. We're looking at an inadvertent omission. This is clearly an omission. If the SVP was never addressed at all, we would definitely have a harder hill to climb. But in the final decree, it's referenced twice. In each qualified court order, it's referenced. Ms. Ruane has to pay for it. To hold to the husband's argument, she has to pay for it, but she doesn't get it, even though he specifically asked the court to award it to her. Ms. Ruane represented to the court that it had already ruled that she'd receive it, not asked for it, represented that that is what the court had ruled at trial. And the court said, I am granting her the maximum survivor annuity. Now, there was argument that he was actually referring to the TSP because he was going down a recitation list. The TSP was never once referred to as a survivor annuity. Not once. It was referred to as a monetary account by the court, by the husband, and by the wife. At ruling, at trial, and in post-trial briefing. Never once was it referenced as a survivor annuity. The only survivor annuity, the only pension benefit in this entire case where there were multiple assets was the SVP. So, yes, it is not, the court may not have used the words SVP when it awarded to her. He used the terms maximum survivor annuity and then said she has to pay for the SVP. So in oral ruling, it switched up. He used a shorthand because that was the only thing the parties were arguing about, and we were arguing about a lot of things in this case. But it's clear that if you look at all 10 points where the court and the parties address it, it was intended, as in Cass v. Lassiter, that this agreement that she received the SVP was there. And the court confirmed it. There's no evidence that the court was going against it. The court itself has made a ruling that it intended to incorporate the agreement of the parties. The husband also argues that at this last hearing with the trial court that he said that he failed to address it. I believe that is extrapolated to the point that it is not consistent with actually what the court was saying. The court was going through all of the areas where it had been addressed and dealt with throughout the record. When it said it failed to address it, it was specifically referring to the fact that it failed to make those specific words, the wife shall receive the SVP, in the final decree. It was not saying it had not addressed it. Because later on is when the court actually says, counsel, we'll note that this court made reference to a division of the pension benefit after deducting the cost of the SVP. There was never a concession by the court that it had never addressed the award of the SVP. So both parties requested it. The court granted the maximum survivor annuity. She was multiple times required to pay for it. There's no way to read these orders consistently with the fact that she cannot receive it. The other language that the husband relies on is this terminating language, saying that it now conflicts, or that the final decree didn't contain language the qualified court order contains. Well, this terminating payments language that they rely on to create a conflict is not in the final decree. So by the husband's argument, that language cannot be included in the qualified court order because it is not in the final decree. And terminating language is never addressed by the court at any point. It was simply boilerplate included in a qualified court order, as they often are. In equitable distribution cases like this, there are multiple issues, and it is common for parties to submit agreements regarding specific assets. The court used a shorthand and simply said, the one issue we're not dealing with on the SVP is how it's going to be paid for. The wife's got to pay for it, but she gets it. That's what the parties want. She's getting the maximum survivor annuity. To hold that the court made no ruling on this whatsoever is incredulous. Clearly, he dealt with it because he ordered her to pay for it. Additionally, the husband argues that it was not a timely held argument. The Supreme Court in Balloon versus Commonwealth said that actually specifically rejected any argument that using 8.01-428B allows the court to look at a timeliness argument. And in Netzer, the Supreme Court actually modified a subject matter jurisdiction issue in a final decree 16 years after the original order was entered and the original judge had deceased. If there are no other questions, believe that it's clear that the court awarded her the SVP as asked by the parties and as intimated by the court and as by rule that she received the maximum survivor annuity. It was a clear inadvertent omission. We ask the court be affirmed in that it did not abuse its discretion, as reasonable jurists could disagree as to how he did this, and it must be that no reasonable jurist could agree with the court. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. White?
Yes.
You have a few minutes left on the clock.
Is that my time, the 6:15?
6 minutes and 15 seconds.
Right. Those words, maximum survivor and annuity, don't appear anywhere in the final order of divorce. Anywhere. They're in the transcript. And it comes right after the TSP. And that argument was raised because we submitted voluminous memoranda to the court prior to going back in November, because we were there before the court in May, we were there in December, and then we ended up there again on this one issue. If it were clearly ordered, we wouldn't have been there in November because DFAS did not accept anything saying the SVP must be specifically ordered.
But counsel, if the trial court said, and I believe he did, the TSP, which was not a retirement issue, will be split, she will receive the maximum survivor annuity, isn't that a court order?
Well, it doesn't appear in the order. It's in
not
the ruling.
In the order.
It's in the ruling.
But it's a ruling from the bench on a fact in the case, is it not?
Not in this case, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why.
Please.
It is never, the survivor benefit plan is referred to as SBP, but it is never referred to as an annuity. There's never a place in the record where it's referred to as an annuity.
What was the maximum, the survivor annuity?
Well, I think that's a question for the court, for the judge. What did you mean? And I think he was very clear in November, and I point you to page 223 of the appendix, where he says, in retrospect, perhaps because the award itself wasn't an issue, the court failed to address it. You can't be any more clear. The judge conceded, I didn't award the SVP. He didn't come back and say, you know, when I said maximum survivor annuity, I really meant the SVP. If he had said that, we wouldn't be here.
Well,
but that's not what he said.
If it wasn't the SVP, what other asset would it have been?
Your Honor, I will tell you, I don't know what the judge is talking about, because the judge gave a ruling and there were many things that had to be clarified. If the panel will note, this went back on a motion for clarification over numerous things that were clarified before the court. Nobody asked him to clarify what he meant by maximum survivor annuity, so no, he didn't do that. But when we were there in November,
you see that there was only one retirement issue, and that was the SPP?
No, there were other retirement issues, Your Honor.
No,
there was,
I'm sorry. The retirement accounts.
There were retirement accounts with Janus funds. There were retirement accounts with the wife.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There were retirement accounts with the wife. There were IRAs. There was the TSP, which is a retirement account. There's the military retirement, which is completely separate from the SVP issue. Had the judge meant maximum survivor annuity, we raised that argument. This is what you meant. If you look at the memoranda we submitted to the court prior to going in November, counsel raised that issue. You ordered it. You said maximum survivor annuity. And the judge came back and said, in retrospect, perhaps because the award itself, he talked about it, he discussed it, we all discussed it. It was never called an annuity. It was always called the SVP, never ever called an annuity. And he could have clarified right there at that moment, you know, that's what I meant when I said maximum survivor annuity. But he didn't. He said, I didn't address it.
What should we take away from the argument, both by the trial court as well as from the appellee, that the trial court, in directing that the wife would pay for the SVP, is highly inconsistent with the fact that she wouldn't get the SVP?
If he had ordered it to go somewhere else, I would say that is inconsistent. But he didn't make the award, so I'm not sure where the inconsistency is. He didn't actually make an award.
Well, the inconsistency is she'd be paying for somebody else's award.
That is a very good issue, but it wasn't brought up by anyone when the court had the opportunity to correct it. It wasn't brought up within the 21 days when the appellee asked for numerous clarifications on other issues. There was never an award made. It was talked about. And I believe that's the Dixon case, where he actually said, this is what I intend to do. I intend to give her a lump sum spousal support award. But he didn't do it. So the judge talked about SVP. Things were discussed about SVP, but no actual award was made at this time. And Rule 1:1 says the 21 days had run. Inadvertent admission, this court may make a stretch and find that that was an inadvertent admission over a long period of time and numerous orders, but we are still left with a quadro or a QCO that doesn't agree with the final decree. And that final decree is not amended to this day as we stand before this court. We don't have a final decree that gives that award. It doesn't exist. So, as we argued, can that QCO, that quadro, carry out the terms of an order that don't exist? This was a substantive change made to this QCO that is not contained in the final order. Had the final order been amended, and then we were arguing that the QCO shouldn't be amended, that would be a different case. But we have a QCO that doesn't carry out the terms of the final decree. So if we actually come to that inadvertent admission, error, mistake, all of those things, we still have a final decree that does not give the SVP to the wife, and that has never been amended. There is no amended final order. So we've got conflicting orders. And we'd ask the court to void this QCO as not being in compliance with what was actually ordered by the trial court. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel, and then the court